It's The Wonky Show. We're talking apprenticeships levy, research culture, and industrial strategy. It's all coming up.
It is really this sort of, you know, what big business wants, stop them wasting their levy spending, labourers appeal to business rather than labourers appeal to, you know, parents who are and voters who don't like universities so much.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and joining me to survey the perimeters of HE policy this week are three brilliant guests as always. In Northampton, it's Sian Waring, Deputy Vice-Chancellor at the University of Northampton. Sian, your hire to the week, please.
Morning, Mark. Probably getting external partners in to sign our Northamptonshire Anchor Charter, where we're trying to work together to improve Northamptonshire as a place to live, thrive, study, work and visit.
And on campus is Ashley Straw-Smith, Student Voice Manager at the University of Nottingham Students' Union. Ashley, your hire to the week, please.
Hey, good morning. So outside of coming back from Disneyland Paris Pride, the key highlight for me this week is launching the new Academic Reps Audit Tool we've been working on for a while to help unions and universities understand how their rep systems work.
And in Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's news editor. Michael, your hire of the week, please.
I think it's just sun is shining, some lovely flowers come out in my garden, and things are good.
So, we start the week with Labour and what it's saying about the apprenticeship levy. Michael, talk us through it.
Yeah, so we got a bit more detail this week about Labour's plans to turn the apprenticeship levy into what they're calling a growth and skills levy. They announced this, I think, around party conference time last September. But it's been a bit of a sort of, you know, a policy soundbite as opposed to one with much detail on. You know, their big idea is that firms will be allowed to spend up to 50% of their levy contributions on non-apprenticeship training, like sort of modular courses, what they've called functional skills courses, overseen by a new body that will be called Skills England. And they'll just be 50% of the levy ring-fenced for apprenticeships. You know, we've had Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Question saying businesses are crying out for more flexibility in the levy. So it's seen as a kind of pro-business, CBI endorsed, back when that was a, you know, something to aspire to. You know, it's that sort of policy, especially aimed at big businesses, which were, at least previously, were struggling to spend all of their levy funds. You know, and the question has been a little bit, okay, so what's going to happen to the smaller businesses, the SMEs, which, you know, don't pay the levy? Traditionally, their apprenticeships have been funded by, you know, what's left over from the big businesses, what they haven't managed to spend. And so this week, Labour's Toby Perkins, who's the Shadow Minister for Skills and Further Education, he sort of made clear in a speech at a conference that Labour's plans are not going to reduce the budget available to non-levy paying companies, so small businesses. You know, not going to stop them from being able to have funding for apprenticeships, because, you know, okay, just to sort of go back in a circle then. So if bigger companies are spending more on sort of short courses and training, there'd be less left over from to go to small businesses. But Toby Perkins has said Labour is going to make, you know, and this is quite interesting in itself because you don't see these too often at the moment, an additional spending commitment, and they're going to safeguard SME apprenticeships. You know, and this could end up being quite a substantial commitment. I don't, you know, it's not something where Labour look to particularly costed it, especially sort of longer term. They also want to drive up the numbers of SMEs doing apprenticeships. So it's probably one to keep an eye on as they actually, you know, see what the Shadow Chancellor and her team start thinking about this commitment, because, you know, it could be into the, you know, perhaps in the order of £1 billion, maybe, I've seen people suggesting. You know, hard to tell, but yeah, it's sort of interesting also because that money is being spent on that and not in other aspects of tertiary education as well, you would think.
So yeah, this is fascinating, isn't it, Sian? I think, you know, because given we've had previously kind of policy making by vibes for Labour and opposition, because they don't want to spend money. This is interesting, isn't it? Because it kind of points to a direction of travel and the sorts of things they might prioritise. And I think that is interesting, as well as the actual policy itself, right?
I think that's right. So first of all, I think I welcome a review of the apprenticeship levy. I think it's a great idea in practice. I think operationalizing it has been very difficult, and it hasn't delivered the benefits I think everybody can see are there. You know, the idea of higher education where the, you know, the cost is picked up by employers is great. That students leave without, you know, students leave with a degree without debt is great. The integration with industry is great, but operationalizing it has been difficult for two reasons. I think it's quite cumbersome. There's a lot of players involved, so just bringing them to the table is difficult. Getting the employers and the FE funding element and Ofsted with universities and the students all being, you know, players in it is really difficult to harmonise. That's one thing. It's difficult to make it cost effective because actually with more elements it costs more. But the other thing has been, it's been very difficult to get employers to agree on standards for apprenticeships that map onto what students want to do, and so it's just been hard to operationalise, which is not at all to say that the principle isn't a great idea. So I think coming back to it is a good idea, but I still think, and we can see this with the lifelong loan entitlement, it's still going to be very difficult to operationalise it. I know that's it's a cliche to say the devil's in the detail, but I think that's exactly where we are.
And actually, where would you prioritise this on? If you know, if you had £1 billion to spend on education and skills, where would you prioritise this?
So I think for me, I think it is important to put investment into apprenticeships, and I think that would be a significant chunk of that. As someone who didn't come from a family who went to higher education full time, and it was a kind of unique myself. I think having a range of opportunities to get into higher education outside of your 3-year undergrad massive loans, I think, is really important. I think the aspect, kind of slightly going back to what Sean's saying around the implementation, I think it's incredibly difficult for SMEs, small and medium enterprises, to get involved in degree apprenticeships. From my experience at Warwick, where we have a lot of big companies creating and doing a degree apprenticeship work, we didn't see really any small or medium enterprises doing it because it was very industry led and they needed a lot of money to get the university to be able to be on board and create that work because they needed a substantial amount of students to start those courses. But then if those industries are big enough, could they just go down the route of Dyson and have their own office for students approved degree awarding apprenticeship school? And I think that actually we could see more of that actually, rather than things being incorporated into universities.
I mean, Michael, it polls well, doesn't it? I mean, apprenticeships, this is why Labour keeps coming back to it. It's why actually, I mean, the Conservatives talk about, when they talk about skills, you know, there's always lines about apprenticeships in there. People like apprenticeships, people like to think they would do one, or they would recommend that their kids do one. Whether or not that they do, or the demand's there, or the partners for business are there, or the funding's there, is this kind of separate matter, isn't it? But do you think we can expect to see more of this kind of thing?
Yeah, in the sense that, as you say, it polls well, it's politically popular. It does feel a bit like there's probably all kinds of, you know, things to be uncovered within the apprenticeship system. We just saw last week, for example, in the Student Academic Experience Survey, that student satisfaction is quite poor, really, compared to regular university study. You know, the dropout rate is still very bad. You know, but while it still is the sort of political flavour of the month, especially at DfE, but also for Labour, you know, I imagine we'll get continued emphasis on it. I mean, I would just sort of say this isn't really Labour saying they're going to do more spending on apprenticeships. More, this is they're going to sort of make up for the funding that will be lost. And really what they're putting money into here is on sort of modular courses, skills courses for big businesses, which, you know, is... And really here, they're just trying to maintain parity and to stop the number of apprenticeships from falling. They've also said they're going to do other things all around sort of reducing burden and making it all a bit more simple. It's not clear yet whether this new body, Skills England, is going to replace the Institute for Apprentices and Technical Education, but it probably will, you would think. You know, so they are doing other moves. But this money is really, you know, goes back to a bit what Sean said about the LLE. It's all about sort of, you know, short courses, you know, for current employees rather than sort of young students. It is really this sort of, you know, what big business wants, stop them wasting their levy spending, Labour's appeal to business rather than Labour's appeal to, you know, parents who are and voters who don't like universities so much.
Mark, to come back in on your question on, you know, where could we be spending that money? I think one of the options would be, and this does pop up in the speech that we're talking about, the Toby Perkins speech, is careers, education, information, advice and guidance from primary schools onwards, because that's an area that has just dwindled and dwindled away. And I think setting routes for children from very early on into areas where there is work, there is productivity, there are, you know, valuable and fulfilling jobs to be done is really important. I think in the absence of that, I think we have to go upstream of the problem, basically. And I think that is into that very early careers, education, information, advice and guidance. That would be one of the things to do with it. And making sure that that continues throughout and is focused on the areas where there's going to be long-term productivity for the country, so that there's that generation of wealth which is actually going to pay for all of these things ultimately. Because if that productivity is dwindling, it's harder and harder and harder to invest in education and public services, which is, I think, where we are at the moment.
Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
This is Joshua Thorpe, and this week I'm blogging about the real risk of generative AI, a sort of a different take on the risks of AI. And I think that kind of centers around a crisis of knowledge, or at least a potential crisis of knowledge, and how that might be tied to our identities in higher education. And for students, this concerns me especially because I think students will have a difficult time figuring out what their identity is and what their role is as producers of knowledge and even as consumers of knowledge, which is pretty much all of university. So that can be very disorienting. So with all this in mind, then the article makes an argument for more criticality and caution in our discussions and integration of AI tools in higher education. How can we do this more cautiously and more humanely as the world around us is changing so quickly?
Now, the debate over reforms to the REF are raging. Ashley, walk us through them.
Yes, so Research Action Framework has discussed around increasing weighting given to people, culture and environment, which will now be worth 25% in 2028, up from 15% in 2021 when this was just called environment, which is a little bit of controversy, a little bit of arguments taking place. I think the first argument taking place is really around whether EDI should get a look in when we're assessing research excellence. The funding councils who have put together the proposals and the initial decisions in the future research assessment program suggest that it should, though consultations will follow. I think it's a really interesting debate. And we're also seeing a wider debate around should we be actually assessing or incentivize good research culture, or just be focusing on what research outputs and the quality of those outputs when it comes to how funding gets allocated. And some really great articles on Wonky this week by Elizabeth Gadd and James Coe, who have supported the idea of using REF to improve research culture, though the former cautions that we need to avoid creating a my research culture is better than yours competition, especially given the massive disparity in resources between institutions.
Michael, we covered this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, when it was all announced. But we recorded on the day that the direction of travel was set. And there's been a really interesting kind of national conversation that started in the wake of that, hasn't there? I mean, least generously, commentators on the right describing it as the REF gone woke. But there are some, you know, there is a legitimate challenge there, isn't there, about how public money is spent and what are we actually trying to achieve by measuring research?
Yeah, there is. And I mean, one of the things that struck me most about when the Future Research Assessment Programme reported was just how independent of government it really felt. You know, we got all the various sector bodies writing to us, you know, saying, you know, if you're covering this tomorrow, here's our comment. We think it's pretty good. We're happy with it. You know, universities as organisations generally, I think, were quite happy. It was a very sort of collaborative endeavour with UKRI, with a panel, with the sector, and not with, you know, the government, with the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology. I mean, they maybe mentioned it in passing, but you know, in a letter they wrote to Research England, but it really barely weighed in on it. It's really interesting to think of the difference between that state of affairs and 9 months ago, when Jacob Rees-Mogg was the business secretary who would have been responsible for UKRI, and, you know, was already talking to the Telegraph about going through UKRI's budget line by line, you know, getting rid of the woke stuff. And it's come at the right time politically. But the flip side of that is you think, well, where could we be in a year? You know, if there is a further reshuffle, I mean, you know, potentially, where could we be in 3 years? Say, if Labour is in power and suddenly all this money that's spent on research becomes a sort of tabloid and right-wing paper line of attack, and, you know, and Suella Braverman's the opposition number at PMQs, and she's, you know, so it is interesting kind of how this issue sort of within the sector, for a few people, became a bit of a big deal about, you know, the EDI question and the culture question. But also, I thought it was interesting how it didn't get traction beyond the sector. And generally, the sector, you know, feels sort of quite happy with the ref.
Mm. Fascinating. Sean, do you think this takes us forward sufficiently?
I think a lot of the opposition is very short term. So I think I'm not sure actually it looks long enough and joined up enough actually for me at this point, but I think we're getting there. But to take Ashley's point about, you know, a further reshuffle, we've had 7 secretaries of state for education in the last 7 years, and I think there's been a real lack of continuity. And one of the big issues for me for research is that we set a foundation for future success, and that's really long term. These are, you know, we develop the technicians and the discovery research which actually drives the future of innovation in the country, and so that's a really long-term plan. And so I really welcome, first of all, EDI at the heart of that, because otherwise look at all the talents and skills we're losing by, you know, the number of people who don't come forward. And I know we all know the statistics on profs, but about 7% 0.7% of professors are black, and about 0.1% are black women, and that means a massive loss of talent. And that talent, that, you know, that plays out long term. This is not just a snapshot of where research is at a particular point in time. Universities are about the future of individuals and the future of society, and I think we need that long term planning. So we need to have that people, culture, and environment in there.
Hmm. I love Michael's theory that because the sort of leadership vacuum in Whitehall right now, the kind of the wokerati managed to get a bunch of stuff out of the door that would have absolutely had a red line put through it by people like Ian Mansfield when he was there, and it kind of explains, I think, why there's been a bit of a backlash from those quarters. But actually, I back to what you're saying about the kind of the broader cultural points. Is there going to be, you know, is it going to also be a kind of kinder, gentler ref, as some have described it? Or, you know, is the nature of measuring research in this way always inevitably going to be a bit of a zero-sum game?
I don't think it's going to be kinder and gentler. I think this is important to have. I think that having EDI involved and this idea of culture involved in research excellence, I think, is just a natural understanding from my perspective. Like, when we have more diversity within research, we get better research because we have more different perspectives putting out things. And actually, as higher education, who has a significant influence on industry, we should be using that for good. I know that was a bit of a misquote of Uncle Ben's "Great Power, Great Responsibility" speech, but I do really feel that as someone who would love the opportunity to go and do research, but haven't been able to do that due to personal and set barriers. I think that the more that we focus on that, the better research we're going to get out anyway. I don't think it's mutually exclusive. I think it actually impacts.
Totally agree with that point, Ashley. I just want to say I completely agree with that. It will be better research with more diversity.
And I mean, Sean, from your perspective in your institution, do you think it's going to help the broader cultural points about research?
I think in the short term, it'll be really hard to fund for institutions like us, but I do think it's the right way to go. So, you know, I think it's... we need to think through what that will mean to us. It's really hard in our part of the sector to put that sort of long-term funding in place, but we are completely committed to that diversity, and we've got schemes to produce that. And I think that is where our good research will come from. It'll come from putting those policies and practices in place.
Mm. But what's the temperature more generally in the university? Are people does this make people dread the ref a little bit less?
I'm finding that really hard to answer, actually, because I think people, probably individual academics, are, you know, focused on their own research areas and their own developments. I'm not sure that this will really shape their view of it. I think it probably does shape our view at a policy level within the institution. But I think we've been going this way for a while. We've been trying to set in place a culture that will underpin, you know, long-term positive research activity right across the diversity of our staff. And we're obviously trying to get our staff body to more reflect our student body, which is, you know, currently more diverse than our staff body. So really seeing research, PhD research, as a pipeline into our future researchers. So we've already had structures in place that are trying to diversify the students who go from our undergraduate body into our research student body, and therefore into our academic staff and up the pipeline to professor. So we've been working on this for a while, so I would see this as supporting our direction of travel.
I do think there is going to be some worries, though, within the sector. I think especially within Russell groups and certain areas like STEM, which have been able to... do not have as much diversity, but being able to rank really high in ref, I think there is definitely going to be a worry about, okay, well, now this is worth 25%. Now this culture stuff is worth so much more. I think there is going to be a lot of scrambling over the next few years to try and see how they can boost things quickly, especially in those areas that have lacked diversity, but because it's not been, or lacked kind of that culture and diversity work, but because it hasn't been high up on the ref's agenda, it means that they've been able to kind of get away with it, for want of a better term.
Well, we have published an absolute mountain of stuff about this on the site, so if you want to dig into some of these debates, you can. And there's a consultation, isn't there, Michael?
Yeah, it's all under consultation at the moment. This is just the initial decisions, so it's, you know, to some extent it's anyone's game, but it does feel at the moment like there's a sort of broad endorsement of what Research England and the other funding bodies are trying to do.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to say to endorse the two great blogs on the Wonky site, the Elizabeth Gadwin and the James Coe. But I was really excited when I got to the James Coe one to see what I'm pretty sure is a picture of Inverary. So it's a boat on a beach, and I'm thinking, I think that's Inverary. So I think everyone should have a look at that, because it was also a highlight of my week to be reminded of a very pleasant holiday there.
And now a word from our sponsor, that's me, with some information about our exciting festival. The Festival of Higher Education is coming. This November, Wonky and the University of London will welcome you to Senate House for two amazing days of one-to-one conversations with HE leaders, set-piece debates and insights from journalists, policymakers and experts. You'll hear from speakers inside and outside the sector, take part in amazing interactive sessions, learn about new research, data and ideas, and meet colleagues old and new. All equipping you with the fresh thinking and insights ready to take back and share with your universities and teams. It's going to be an unmissable event for anyone with an interest in the future of UK higher education. That's 7th and 8th of November in London. Early bird tickets are available only until the end of June, so do hurry if you want to take advantage of these. Find out more and book your tickets at thefestivalofhe.com or follow the links from Wonky. We can't wait to see you in November. Now, former University and Science Minister David Willetts has weighed back into debate about industrial strategy and science. John, walk us through it.
Yes, so David Willetts has followed up in revisiting his 8 Great Technologies pamphlet a decade on. So he identified 8 powerful world-changing technologies that he argued the government should invest in. And he saw these as drivers of ways that we'd be working and solving global problems. So he was arguing that it was imperative that we develop an infrastructure in the UK to support innovation in these technologies. So for prosperity and for thriving. So we'd identify things like AI, robotics, genomics, agri-science, nanotechnology. So what you could see actually is the work that he's doing in this as identifying the root cause of not enough cash into public services and higher education, that generation of prosperity is actually what underpins the work of higher education. A lot of the problems we're seeing at the moment and in terms of industrial action as well, there simply isn't the funding to support the work that we want to do at the moment. So that underlying prosperity is really key, I think. He does talk about universities being where a lot of the crucial research happens, that they train researchers and technicians. And he's also really critical that no one has overall view of funding and performance of our universities. which he sees as a key national asset. So I think that's really positive. He's very critical of splitting agendas between government departments, where one department pushes forward, another one holds back, and he includes the OFS in the handbrake departments, sees it as heavily interventionist. And what he suggests is that universities should sit in the new Department of Science, Innovation and Technology with a focus on innovation. So I think that's really positive. And then the question comes, as we were talking about earlier on the podcast, what happens to the parts of education that might not fit in there, like FE? So I think the big challenge is really, do areas like FE and apprenticeship sit with university education? Does university education sit with science, innovation, and technology? So I think there's lots to welcome here, and it's really recommend. It's a very well-written, engaging and charming paper, actually. He says that he himself doesn't feel he comes from a technology background, had to have it explained to him very patiently, but he does see a lack of technology education as a problem in government that makes us a bit phobic about it as in the UK. And he does also criticise early division at 16 into science or arts as part of a problem. He wants post-16 education to allow people to have a much broader base across science and arts subjects, which again I think is to be welcomed.
This question about, you know, whether universities should sit in DSIT or DfE, I mean, it's one of those kind of like, yes, obviously it should be in DSIT, next please, right? I mean, is there any, you know, is there even a debate to be had about that?
Yeah, I guess it's a sort of mechanics question, like how would that actually work? Like DSIT would then have responsibility for the Office for Students. How's that going to fit in with the LLE? I mean, is the LLE, you know, the moment that is the funding model, you know, it does that fully close the door on the idea of just universities going to DSIT? And, you know, as Shine has said, I think there's a interesting question about, you know, the whole of the tertiary system going back into a sort of, you know, innovation and skills and science sort of department, which everybody would love. As you know, I think especially at the moment, okay, DSIT's a very new department. You know, they're doing some things very well in terms of, you know, lots of sort of posts on Twitter and that kind of thing. But it is really new and is still being set up. Lots of the civil servants, I think, are still, you know, in the wrong building and all this sort of thing. But I think, you know, what people see in the sector when they look at you know, DSIT, but even BEIS to some extent, is that these are departments that sort of take pride in and celebrate the work that they fund and are responsible for. And I think we would all agree that pretty much, you know, sort of to 90% at least, the Department for Education just doesn't do this across its whole sector. I mean, it loves its apprenticeships, as we've talked about. There's, you know, it likes doing well in the PISA league tables, but even for schools, it's not really celebrating them, is it? And, you know, so people are very keen on this idea that it would be, you know, first of all, as I said before, more hands-off. If we look at how, you know, the development of the REF, it's not really been too meddled in with government. And also it would be more sort of, you know, welcoming and sort of celebratory. You know, whether these things would happen in practice, who knows? Because it would be a really fundamental change to, you know, the media attention that this government department gets and all kinds of different things. But, you know, it's one of those nice sort of championship manager style, you know, thought experiments about how you would organise government if it was up to you. I'm quite interested to know what your thoughts are, Mark, although I think you've pretty much made them clear already.
there's a good policy wonk term, absorbative capacity, which is about if you want to turn, you know, science, technology, innovation, all of that into actual productivity, you know, in places and in good, you know, good properly paying jobs, then you need to have a slightly more you know, joined up system, which starts, you know, starts with skills, you know, it doesn't necessarily end with higher education, but kind of links all those things up. And I think it feels like the missing piece of the puzzle for this sort of much smarter type of industrial strategy. I mean, we can move the pieces around Whitehall, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to give us that link between this, you know, high amount of investment in science innovation to, as I say, good jobs for people, better quality of life, and a more productive economy on the other end. And I'm just thinking, I mean, actually, I wonder if you think there is a case that the sector, a better or stronger case the sector can make about its role in that wider loop as we head into a general election, and what should that be?
I completely agree. I definitely think that the sector and universities individually and a collective should be showing their kind of force and ability to boost economic growth. I think specifically when it comes to these aspects around kind of the industrial strategy and these eight great technologies, I think it is trying to get the universities kind of, like what we were talking about earlier about linking back with industry. I think it's that aspect of how are we showing that that journey, how are we showing it from starting an undergraduate degree to research to that implementing key industry within the UK and within the world. And I think that universities, because of their choppy relationship with the government over the past 10 years at least, I think there is an apprehension to put their head above the parapet a little bit, where actually if they did that, I think there would be much more sympathy when it comes to issues that universities and higher education is facing from the general population.
Well, I agree with Ashley and Michael's points. I think in terms of the things we've been talking about today, they are all connected up. They do all fit within an overarching industrial strategy. We do need to support top level research and innovation. We also need to support a workforce to enable that. And there are both economic advantages, but also, of course, social advantages in terms of education leading to work that leads to people having, prosperous and secure lives and generating the prosperity that feeds back into education and social services. So I agree with the points that Michael, Ashley, and you've made about it all connecting up.
And I guess, Michael, perversely, there's probably more kind of receptive ears in Labour right now for this sort of it's sort of closer to that their sort of mission led approach, isn't it, than the Conservative Party, which seems to me a bit more focused on, you know, the next election and staving off disaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not that something that's going to happen under this Conservative government that is just sort of, you know, as you say, really in the last throes of its legislative agenda and unlikely to be doing any big changes like this, which also, you know, wouldn't play to its base. But for Labour, you know, I imagine and I hope and I would recommend that the sector is behind the scenes, you know, as much as there is a sort of HE policy apparatus in Labour yet, which, you know, if there is, it's not very big. But, you know, they don't have all their sort of teams and manifesto writing going on on a grand scale yet. But I would think the sector should be, you know, dropping a few hints about this, suggesting a little bit. I mean, at the moment, what we can do is sort of read the runes a bit, you know, do we have any signals coming out of Labour that they might do this? I mean, I think, so on the one hand, they still have a shadow higher education minister, Matt Weston, and a separate FE and skills minister, Toby Perkins, who we've mentioned earlier. I mean, unlike in the Conservative government. So that is sort of suggestive that they might be thinking that these are sort of two separate areas. On the other hand, they still don't have a shadow DSIT minister, secretary. You know, there's no science secretary, technology secretary on their benches. You know, this machinery of government change was back in, I think, the very beginning of March, and they haven't got anyone in place sort of in the opposition brief for there. It was rumoured, in fact, this week that it might be Lucy Powell, who's currently shadow culture secretary, but, you know, maybe not until a reshuffle around conference sort of time in the autumn. So, you know, from that side, we could say it doesn't seem to be a big priority for Labour. And there's not an obvious person who the sector should be talking to and going, oh, do you fancy adding universities to your area of responsibility? So hard to know. But I imagine if this were ever going to happen, it would be under a future Labour government. Mm-hmm.
I am shocked, actually, how little joined up the policies are. So in probably three dimensions. So one is how we link excellence and skills. So the research innovation and the base and, you know, general skills across the population. So that's one. Another is the total educational journey from early years, primary, right the way through to HE and you know the and Post-16 and HE. And then the third bit, I was really shocked looking at where it mentions England and where it doesn't. I think there's absolute confusion about what policies apply across England, Wales and Scotland and where they don't. And that has huge impact for where students study, for how staff travel. Does the lifelong learning entitlement follow you if you're an English student going to a university in Scotland? And the questions there are enormous, and it's very divisive across the country, and then that exacerbates disparities in prosperity across the country too. So I think the first step would be to have a vision that just connected up early years education right through to HE excellence with the skills that the whole population needs, and then took a holistic view across England, Scotland and Wales.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So, thanks very much to Sean, Michael and Ashley. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. In the meantime, stay wonky.